The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories. From World War II...
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
...to the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is Jim Lavelle. He is a veteran of the United States Navy, a survivor of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and he was also very much present at another major moment in American history, and that was Jack Ruby's shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald. We'll get to that a little bit later in our conversation. Mr. Lavelle, thank you very much for your time today. Let's start at the very beginning. Where were you born and raised?
I was born down in Red River County. That's southeast of Dallas area. Folks moved around quite a bit. We moved out to West Texas area and stayed 2 or 3 years and then back to Red River County.
When did you join the Navy?
It was in 1940. I signed up in 1939 after I got out of school. I missed the last year of my school in 37, 38. When I turned 17, I joined the Civilian Conservation Corps that Roosevelt had started, and I spent a year out in New Mexico in that, and then I came back in, that was in 37, and I came back in 39 and went my last year of school, and then I signed up for the Navy, or put my name in. At that time, they was having trouble getting enough recruits to hold, for a company to send through training. So I had to wait a while, and I don't remember what month it was. Well, it was in the early part of 1940.
And when were you stationed at Pearl Harbor first?
Never was stationed there. We just went in and out of there because I was aboard ship. When I first went in, I was assigned to a destroyer. And the destroyer was assigned to one of the aircraft carriers. And because they had two destroyers that escorted those carriers around, one on either side, wherever they went. And, of course, their main, the way we helped them at that time was, since the war wasn't on, when we'd go out to sea, the pilots would like to practice landing and taking off and landing on the flat top. And we would just cruise along beside them because sometimes their tail hook would miss that chain, that hook that they catch to stop them. And if they and quite often, they would go over the side on one side or the other. And our job was to, we stayed in pretty close to them if they went over the side. We had a boat that was hung out over the side of the ship, and it was, you could trip a trigger and it dropped that boat right into the water immediately. And they would, and the time that boat hit the water, the motor was already running and there was two men aboard it. And they would run to where that airplane landed and pick up the pilot. We never lost a pilot, but we did lose a ship or plane a couple times. But we never did lose a pilot.
You mentioned, obviously, this was before the attack on Pearl Harbor, and we weren't at war. Did most people have the sense that eventually you would be going to war, or did most people think it wouldn't happen?
May or June, probably. Of 1941, we went on a full alert because everybody was saying we were going to go to war with Japan immediately. And
well, let's go to the morning of Sunday, December 7th. Where were you, and how did you learn what was happening?
Well, I was aboard ship, and it happened just a few minutes before 8 o'clock, but I didn't know. I didn't look at the clock, so it didn't make any difference. But they had just served breakfast on there, and everybody was, and it's on a Sunday. They couldn't have picked a better day to do it, because we get paid twice a month, and the day before was our payday. So everybody's getting ready to go and spend their $12 or $15 that they got. It didn't last long, but then I'd say half the fleet was getting ready to go ashore after that. And I was planning on going later that day, but not then. And the shore boats didn't leave. You couldn't till 8 o'clock. That's for earliest any of those ships could send out their boats carrying the sailors over to the dock for them to catch a bus into town. And there were several of them ready to go. But I've often thought that it would have been quite a worse deal if they had just waited a few minutes longer, because that bay would, all those ships had the same deal. They didn't leave till 8 o'clock. So they'd had all these boats headed into the shore loaded with sailors, our Marines, if they was on a ship that had carried Marines. And but fortunately, it had just a few inches before they were left. And, of course, everybody was able to man their battle stations.
So where did you go as soon as you knew?
Mine was on, I was a loader on that four-inch gun that shot 30 miles. If you got in a battle with other ships and things like that, that's what that was for. So I never fired a lot. We loaded it and had it ready, but it was useless to fire at planes a half a mile up with that, with a gun like that. If I had fired it back in the direction where the planes were from our ship, it would have landed somewhere in Honolulu over there. But so I never fired a shot. So I told myself I can't claim any victory on Pearl Harbor Day, because I didn't fire anything.
You were aboard the USS Whitney,
yeah,
at that time. Where was it positioned related to some of
it's
the other ships?
In the, I've always had problems with the directions on that, but in the northeast end of the harbor. And I'd say we was a good 2 miles away over there. But out on the sea or ocean or any water, bay of water, if you're a mile or two away, it looks like it's just a little ways over there. You have perfectly good view of it. So we had a real good view of everything that was going on, but there was nothing we could do about it. We got orders, all the ships were given orders, all the commanders were given orders, if anything happened, to get their ships out of the harbor. That was, and our captain had the same orders. And they were, after it broke out, those orders were reissued to the commanders of ships, and we got that. But in our deal, we had four destroyers tied up beside of us, and they had to get their ship moving and get unhooked and move and so forth, and it take a little time and all of that. And one of them had tore down all their guns and was going over and cleaning them up and doing, I don't know what they're doing to them, working on them anyway. So they never got theirs into firing at all. But the others that were hooked, that was able to, they got their aircraft manned and so forth. They had 3-inch and 2-inch, or the 50 caliber rather, they had the 3-inch aircraft and then the 50 caliber guns. And the ones that could get into action, they did, but one of them, of course, they couldn't because they had their guns tore down. And we got orders to move, but before we could, we have so much stuff, like acetylene barrels and stuff like this along out on the deck to be used for the ship to tie up to us if they need it. And we have to get all those tied down before you move or get up stationed. So we weren't able to get that into our deck. People wasn't able to get that done. And then finally, we got orders to stay put, not to go. But we had clear view of all the other deals, and a lot of the ships, commanders got their ships moving, some of the destroyers and so forth had them going. I don't know what destroyer it was, but there was one going out the channel and with all guns blazing. But they also had a fire going on it. They'd caught fire. They'd been hit, so they was on fire. But their fireman was working on that. You see, that channel was so shallow that if they sunk a ship in it, then no other could go in and out. And, of course, the Japanese knew that, too. They had been told that because they had good history on what was going on and how to work against it. And so, in fact, the commander of the Nevada, the battleship Nevada, he cranked up and got out, but he was burning fore and aft. He had a fire going on both. They had going on both ends, and the fireman was fighting it. And of course, the other guns that was up on the deck up, they were firing. The Japanese saw that, had that battleship going in that, and they took after him because they wanted to sink him in that channel. Well, he used his head. He's a smart deal. He turned that battleship and run it aground. And as a result of that, they saved it and later on put it back into commission and running it. But he used his head, and that was because he realized what they were going to do if he got into that channel, so he just run it aground. There's a lot of heroic things took place that day by different people and so forth. One boatswain mate, their ship was tied up to the harbor docks, and they started backing. He had to get out and throw that rope off that had it anchored to the dock, and the ship started backing out, and he jumped into the bay, climbed up that anchor rope and got back on his ship. But there was an untold number of really brave things that was done by the sailors and Marines and Army and so forth. And it's just innumerable.
Mr. Lavelle, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back on Veterans Chronicles.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Honored to be joined today by Jim Lavelle. He's a veteran of the United States Navy, survivor of Pearl Harbor, and as you may know already, he was very much present at the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963. We'll get to that in a moment. Sir, you were just talking about the heroism at Pearl Harbor and so many different acts that it's hard to even list them all. Once the attack had ended, what was going on in your mind? What was going on? What was the general sense aboard?
Everybody had been drilled on the fact that if something like that happened, there would be a landing following it, and it's a common battle practice. And every sailor and Marine and so forth was familiar with that. The boatswain mate that was standing up there with me when the first plane came in, that's the first thing he thought of and mentioned it, and I think he put it out over the general alarm system, too, that we might be have a ground invasion later, because that was a normal thing to do. You bomb the shore facilities or whatever they have, and then you come in with a ground invasion. So that's what we was all looking for. That's what we'd been taught, and so that's what we look for. But fortunately, they didn't have that. They didn't follow it up. Well, they wasn't prepared to anyway, and as it turned out.
How soon were you able to get back out and go back to what you had been doing and escorting destroyers?
Well, the next day, after we got rid of the destroyers that was tied up to us, we went back over next to Pearl the island and Ford Island. These ships that was badly damaged, and one of them, I forgot the name of it. It was a cruiser. It was named after a city out of Missouri. That much I remember. And all of their entire electrical power was knocked out. Well, we had full electrical power, and so we pulled in every side that and run lines over to them, so their electricians could hook up, and we stayed with them until they got all of their stuff running, and then we moved on to another one, and so that's what we did for a while to get the others back into running condition.
And then for the remainder of the war, did you stay on the Whitney?
The doctor told me that after being getting hurt at sea, I've done all I can do for you, so we're going to ship you back to the States, and so... about the middle of December or something like that, I ended up back on the stateside, and then eventually they sent me down to Corona, California, where the Navy had taken over a country club down there and made a hospital out of it. The chief doctor tried to get him to send me back to sea, and he wouldn't do it, and he said, no, I won't authorize you to go back to sea. And finally, he just told me, he said, I'll okay you for shore duty. I said, I don't want shore duty. I want to go back to sea. So he and I had a lot of little arguments about that. And, of course, he won, and he had the authority. But later on in the Air Force, United States Air Force, came into there and was going to build a huge warehouse there and did that to handle everything that all of their planes needed. And so if anything, if they needed something, they just sent it. They know where to go to get it. Well, to shorten the story, the commander opening that deal, they had problems getting enough employees. And they came over and asked the chief doctor if he had anybody that was with supply experience. Well, Lavelle is eligible for a discharge if he wants it, and because he wants to go to sea, and I can't authorize it because I don't think he'd hold up out there very long in the bucking sea, rough weather. And he said, but he's eligible for a discharge if he wants to take it. So they come, I was making $36 a month, so they come and talk to me and ask me about taking a discharge and coming to work for them. If you'll take your discharge and come over and we can hire you as a civilian, we'll pay you $125 a month. So I wasn't too good at arithmetic, but I could figure out the difference between 30 and 125, and it's basically the same thing you'd be doing in shore duty. So I talked about it, and I have, at that time I was keeping company with one of the nurses pretty close, and when I asked her about my decision, if I took it, and I said, if I don't like it, then I'll go back to my home and see what I can do. And I asked her if she'd like to go with me, and we were walking down by the lake, and she took about two steps and said, yeah, I believe I would. So that's how I got engaged, and then we did get married, and it lasted 72 years. I just lost her this October, a year ago. I went and worked with them for about a year and a half, and then I took another job up in the Sierras for a while, and then I had to go back to the hospital. So when I left that, I went back to the Naval Hospital in Arizona, and when they released me there, I went on back down in Texas and visited my family a while, and then I went back to Dallas and went to work for the federal government as an auditor. And
let's pause right there. I think you're about to tell us about your joining the police department, so we'll pick up that story in just a moment on Veterans Chronicles.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good,
but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Honored to be joined today at the American Veterans Conference by Jim Lavelle. He's a veteran of the United States Navy, survivor of Pearl Harbor. And we're about now to discuss the other major historical event in American history that he was a part of. And, sir, when you left off, you were talking about returning to Dallas, and you were about to tell us about your latest employment move.
And I saw an ad for the by the Dallas Police Department for police officers, and I went down and signed up and took their examination, and I went to work in 1950 with the Dallas Police Department. And at that time, you had to stay in patrol for 5 years before you could take a promotional examination. So in about 56 or 7, I took my promotional examination and become a detective, and shortly thereafter I moved into the homicide division and stayed there the rest of my career. In 1963, when the President Kennedy came for a visit, he was assassinated. And one of the things that happened after his assassination was Oswald, who had shot the President, made his way to Oak Cliff. Officer J.D. Tippit stopped him and to question him. You'd stop somebody because you're looking for someone, and they had given him a general description of what Oswald looked like from the people that saw him in the window when the shots were fired. So he stopped and just merely questioned him about what his name and so forth. But I had four good witnesses that was a witness to the shooting of Tippit. And all of them gave about the same description, that they said that when Tippit pulled up on the side of the street there and called Oswald over, he was driving along about 10 miles an hour. Actually, that wasn't his beat, because they took the man out, called the man out from that beat and worked downtown, and they called Tippit in from the outlying area to cover that particular area. So he just pulled him over, and I'd done the same thing many times. I was looking for somebody, and I'd see somebody walking along the street that resembled him. I would stop him and talk to him, and of course, 99 times out of 100, you sent them on the way because they wouldn't know who you're looking for. That's what would have happened with Tippit. Had Oswald been able to think long enough about it, because Tippit had called him over to the car door, and he leaned in and talked to him, they said, for a few seconds, and then Tippit got out and started walking around the front of the car to get to him, and Oswald stepped back 2 or 3 feet, and when Tippit got to the left front fender of the car, Oswald pulled out his pistol and went into that Marine stance that he'd been taught, and then just bang, 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 bang 4 times, just like that. He didn't move his gun up and down, he had left it steady. And so the first shot that hit Tippit was down, was low along the belt area, and the next one a little higher. And what caused it, what he did, is he went forward with the first shot, and he's starting turning to his left, and the bullet walked on up his body as he fell. And the last one, when he was going down, he fell on his left side, and as he went down on the left on there, his head passed the line of view, line of shots, and the bullet hit him in the temple and come out the top. Now we have a lot of conspiracy people saying that Oswald walked around the car, back of the car, very nonchalant like, and shot him in the temple because of the direction of the bullet. Well, I served as a technical advisor for Oliver Stone when he made the JFK movie, And we come to that, we had a little discussion about it. He wanted to write that Oswald, some idiot had said that they Oswald just casually walked around the car and shot him in the head. Because that's the only way they'd had that bullet going at an angle through his head. But I told Stone, I said, that ain't the way it happened. And so I said, if that when because when Oswald finished up, he turned to run. He run by the porch where the Davis sisters were standing and kicked the empty holes out of his gun and passed a cab driver over there that had a clear view of it. And as he passed that, he said the he said to himself, the poor dumb cop or the poor damn cop, the driver wasn't sure what he said. But that told me that Oswald had no intention of shooting that officer. He just didn't know what, if he'd just been using his head a little bit and gave Tippett his identification and everything, Tippett would have looked at it and passed him on. And went, but Oswald wasn't thinking fast enough to do that. And of course, then the conspiracy people got come out with this, that he came around the car. Of course, the most silliest thing about all of that analysis is, here he's done just killed the president and then killed a police officer, and he's going to casually take time to walk around the car and shoot him again? No, it ain't going to happen. And I explained to when they was making the movie what had happened. Oliver's kind of questioned it, and I said, well, let me gut shoot you and see if you won't turn around and stoop over. But he didn't want to go that far, so he went on up, took off, and as he's running across the parking area there, a lot that didn't have any cars on it to speak of, and there was a used car lot down on the corner, and that man that owned it and his a tenant had worked him there. They run out and they saw Oswald with the pistol still in his hand and running across there, and he had a tan jacket on, and he was smart enough to know that if he got described, they'd describe that he's wearing a tan jacket. So he took that jacket off and tried to throw it underneath the car as he went by. And of course, with their information, we recovered the jacket, and then Marina later identified the jacket as his. So, and then he went up Jefferson Street, and then I guess he saw two police cars coming, and he turned into a shoe store and pretended to be looking at shoes, except the shoe store owner didn't have any customers, and he's standing in the back of his store and listening to all this going on the radio, because every radio and every TV was covered with it. And he saw Oswald come in and pretend to be looking at shoes, but he's looking over his left shoulder. And these two police cars went by, and then he walked out to the sidewalk area and looked both ways and then headed west again. So that made him suspicious, and he followed him. And when he got up to the Texas Theater, instead of buying a ticket, he just darted in the door, went in and sat out. So the shoe store man, he told the ticket seller there, he said, I think the man that shot the officer just went in here. He said, you ought to call the police. So they called, and the rest is history, because they swarmed on there and arrested him, and he tried to fight with them, but they overpowered him, brought him in. So he was brought in as a suspect in the killing of Tippett. He wasn't brought in for the president deal yet. Consequently, when I got to come in and was signed to him, I actually went out to where Tippett was shot and then tried to go to the theater, but the traffic was such I couldn't get there. And I called the dispatcher and told him to tell him to take him to my office and I'd meet him there. But they were driving a marked car and I was driving a plain car, and they got there ahead of me. When I got in, he was sitting in an interrogation room by himself. So I walked in and sat down and started talking to him and about Tippett. I didn't mention the president because I had no idea he was going to be a suspect in that, too. And I had him some 10 or 15 minutes, maybe 20 at the most, before Captain Fritz came back from the school book depository where he was. He and the other officers had been searching. Of course, when they went into the school book depository, they went in expecting to find a stranger. They wasn't looking for an employee. But when they didn't find no stranger, then he asked the Mr. Truly, the manager, to do a head count. Well, Oswald was the only one missing, and he, Captain, said, "I want to talk to that man. Give me his address." So they gave him his address and everything, but he had given them a phony address. He didn't live there. Somebody in the office there said, "The captain, the man Lavelle's talking to, has got a name similar to that," because he had told him he wanted to look for somebody named Oswald. And that shows you how closely they was paying attention to the prisoners that brought in. And so Cap come to the door and opened it and asked me what his name was, and I told him, and then he asked the officer, "Where do you work?" He said, "At the school book depository." The captain says, "You're the man I want." So I lost my prisoner. The captain took over, and I never questioned him any further. But I already had pretty good information from him as it was to help me. But he was assigned to me as my prisoner. Therefore, everything that took place went through me. And when he was, when we was transferring him, it was still, my, since he was my prisoner, it was up to me to head up the moving. And that's what I did, and that's how I come out to be handcuffed. That was one question that's been asked quite a bit. Why was I handcuffed to him? But he was my prisoner. He was assigned to me.
And when Ruby stepped forward?
Yeah, as we got walked into the basement down there on the transfer, I saw Ruby. He was facing me about 5 or 6 feet away. And I always make it a habit when I go into a room where there's where I'm doing an investigation, I always look up and down the people that I see. And I saw Jack Ruby. He was standing right there in front, and he had the pistol in his left hand, holding it against his left leg right tight. And, of course, I knew immediately what was going to happen when I saw that. None of the police officers filled in that area or the newspaper people saw that pistol in his hand. Of course, I gave them a bad time later on, all of them. I said, "If y'all had been looking sharp enough, you'd look and saw him with that pistol, you could have wrestled him down there, and you could have been heroes. But as it is, you left it for me to be to confront him." So I walked in, and he made two quick steps, which brought him into arm's length to me. And I reached over past Oswald, caught him by the left shoulder, and was pushing back. But he had switched the pistol over to his right hand and shot. And of course, I jerked Oswald back, trying to pull him behind me. So as when I jerked back on him, I turned his body. Instead of the bullet hitting him dead center, it hit him about 4 inches to the left of the navel on the left side, and went through the stomach. Hit, cut the vena cava in the back, and went over on the, through the left or the right side, hit the liver, took a chunk out of that, and then cut one of the main arteries over on the right side, and hit the end of the seventh rib and shattered it, and glanced off, and landed about 3 or 4 inches to the right, almost even with where it went in on the right side. In fact, if it hadn't been for that rib catching that bullet, it if it had missed it, it'd come on and hit me in the side over here. But it hit that rib and bounced off. And when I examined him later on, I could roll that bullet around underneath the skin just like that with my thumb and finger. So when I got him to the hospital, they called an ambulance right away, and there happened to be one that was returning to their office from a call. And they accepted the call and come up there. So they were there very shortly. When I got him to the hospital out there and rolled him into the operating room, the doctors was already there, ready to go. And I told him, I said, "Before you do anything else, I want that bullet out of him." So I showed them where it was, and they just pinched it up and hit it with a scalpel, and it popped out into a tray that a nurse was holding. I wiped it off with some Kleenex or something, and took my pocket knife and had a sharp knife point on it, and I gave it to the nurse that was holding the tray. And I told her, I said, "I want you to scratch your initial on the butt end of this bullet, because you and I, somewhere down the line, is going to be testifying that this is a bullet come out of Oswald." I then returned to the office and made up the case report for filing on him for the murder. I felt like they needed to hear it, so and then, of course they took no action on it. Well, they did. I say they took no action. They did indict Ruby for murder, and we tried him the following year and got the death penalty on him. But the Court of Criminal Appeals overturned it and sent it back for retrial. It seems like that the judge that was hearing the case was writing a book about the trial, and they were afraid that he would use some decision in the favor of his book rather than the prisoner. I don't know that he would do it, but the obvious would be there. It might be what happened. So they overturned it, and I think it's a proper thing to do that they did. And we reset him for trial in February the 10th of 1967. And he died on January the 4th or 5th of 1967 of cancer that he had developed while in jail.
Sir, we're just about out of time. How long did you serve in the police force before retiring?
Something over 25 years and 3 or 4 months, something like that.
Sir, thank you for your service. Thank you for coming to the conference, and thank you for being with us today.